services, Lavazzi at boom1.co.uk present the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast, episode 211. And with me this week is, oh, by the way, I'm Adam. And kill them! Here's Kirby Bartlett Sloan.
The device is ready.
And Mary Lang?
I'd never felt there was a place I belonged to.
And Matthew Kressel.
We are the masters of Earth.
Are you? And unfortunately, Robert can't be with us today. He's gone and bought Rhys Parton's Book of Excuses. Therefore, will not be attending the show. This week, we're looking at, amongst other things, and do you know what I forgot to do last week? It was the news. I forgot to do the news last week, so let's try not to do it this week. It's the Dalek invasion of Earth.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. I sense something. Someone didn't like it.
Ooh, no, let's talk about that later. Right. On the DVD, I'm going to select, whilst I'm reviewing it, I'm going to do episode selection, because unfortunately, where you get all the episodes in one bar, trying to sort of scroll through bits of it very quickly, very difficult when you've got all the episodes in front of you. Anyway, it begins...
I agree.
It begins with a sort of man with a strange helmety thing. Oh, God, that sounds a bit awkward, doesn't it? A strange head... strange headwear. Wandering past a very sort of atmospheric sign, and dare I say it, what's another word for it? It's a sort of legendary sign that says it's forbidden to dump bodies into the water or into the Thames or something like that, but it's iconic. That was the word I was looking for.
That is the real Kew Railway Bridge, and then they reproduced it almost exactly for the... studio shots.
That's brilliantly done, is it not? Anyway, so Chappie, he decides, it looks like he's basically committing suicide, and just after he drops into the Thames, the TARDIS quietly materialises.
The window's open.
Well, but they're not real windows, Kirby. They're sort of chameleon sort of circuits generated windows.
By the way, the reason they chose that particular bridge was it was close to a hospital, because they if the stuntman had swallowed any of that water, he could have become quite sick.
Yeah. And they also, it was originally supposed to be Hammersmith Bridge, but then they realized how the difficulties of trying to replicate it in studio, so it was changed to Kew Bridge, this location here.
Okay. Although the really interesting thing about the Kew Bridge is that the lattice work on those girders, it's just different. It really looks cool, and they reproduced that for the one that blocks the TARDIS later anyway.
Anyway, back to the story. It's interesting to note that when they're all wandering around the TARDIS console room, that we've actually only got a backdrop view of the rest of the TARDIS.
I was wondering about that. What happened to the roundels?
Yeah, because we all know that was all there. But that part of the TARDIS, Mary, in earlier episodes of Doctor Who, they actually wandered around. You got the scanner up there, which is just a photograph of the scanner rather than the actual scanner itself. Those parts of the TARDIS did exactly exist because we've seen them. But in this episode, it was just a backdrop.
Can I explain?
Yeah, well, I suppose so.
Something that's talked about in the commentary for episode 2 is that for the early episodes of this story, they were stuffing the studio they were filming in at Riverside to capacity with scenery. Yes. It was something that Verity Lambert says was referred to within the design department in the BBC as Verity Lambert syndrome. So they were, studio space was at a premium. You know, and the TARDIS set, as they say, was absolutely huge. That's the reason why in a lot of these early stories, particularly during the first and second Doctor eras, you'll see it at the beginning of a story and at the end of a story, because otherwise it was just too big to leave in a studio all the time.
Plus, there's a story.
Is it what? A story what?
A story to tell in between the beginning and the end.
Yeah, yes.
Thank you for that. anyway, so what?
Somebody is selling that poster we were just talking about on eBay.
So they all clamber out of the TARDIS and have a little poke around, and then quite conveniently the bridge falls on. Oh yeah, Susan, just for old time's sake, twists her ankle.
Yes, Fred was quite amused at that.
Oh yeah.
Well, it is her last story.
And also she's obviously got very weak ankles. And of course the bridge falls on top of the TARDIS.
And
indestructible.
Fred and I also saw Barbara go and dip her handkerchief in that river, and we were going, ew
indeed. Yeah.
Me too.
So Ian and the Doctor go off into a nearby warehouse to have a poke around while Barbara uses the magic damp cloth. Apparently that's a magical cure for twisted ankles. Anyway, so they look out the window and see a nice view of London, and then Barbara gets sort of taken away by a man who's panicking about something or other. Are you mad? What are you doing out here? The Doctor and Ian roll a box over which contains a Robo Man. Well, I thought that would probably be a little bit smelly. They probably would have actually smelt the Robo Man before entering the room.
He was moving. That Robo Man was moving around quite a bit for being dead.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Yeah, I did consider that to be the case. Really weird. And Ian nearly falls down a gaping hole.
Bernard Cribbins did a better fall.
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't seen
for the same scene.
I've seen the Daleks movie quite a lot. I haven't seen the movie version of this anywhere near as many times. I'm sad to say. I'd love to see it again. I haven't seen it for a long time. Anyway,
well, you need to get it. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
It's like the difference between that story and that version is about as much difference as there is between the Adam West Batman film and the more recent Dark Knight trilogy. You know, it's like comparing apples and oranges. You know, and one's some quite serious and a bit gritty and dark, and the other one's, you know, how light and fluffy can we possibly make this story?
Yes. Anyway, Yeah, what happens here? David's hiding in the... we don't know he's David yet, but he's hiding in the warehouses and moves an oil can to one side.
A Shell oil can.
Yes. A Shell oil can.
That was
indeed
very, very unusual for them to show a logo.
A product placement, yes. I tell you what was brilliant, and I absolutely loved these sort of... which were probably the first proper, you know, location scenes in Doctor Who. Around these sort of derelict dock areas of London, and they look fantastic with Barbara
St. Catherine's dock.
And they were padded out, but they were so beautiful to watch. I'm so glad they did pad them out in this episode.
It does a really good job of selling that this is London deserted, and I think even more so for the scenes we'll see in episode 3.
Although interestingly, even though those docks, those warehouses were deserted, those cranes, some of them were actually seeing them from a slight distance. They're close by.
Kirby.
But those are the same cranes that were dipped a year later for Winston Churchill's funeral.
All right. Kirby.
Yes.
When you said about the docks, so were there two docks in London by any chance?
Yes, it was a paradox.
Yes.
If the Doctor was there, there'll be that's two docks in London, which is therefore a
paradox.
Trio?
Sorry, I've got a glass of Heineken in front of me, just as by paying homage to the TARDIS Tavern.
I have a diet citrus drop extreme. Mm.
Well, TARDIS Tavern used to listen to our podcast a long, 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 long time ago. They probably still think Alicia's on it. Weird. Anyway, back to the episode. I did love those scenes. All the scenes, the location scenes in London are really atmospheric and really, really good. And also, I'll tell you what, the scene dressing, the studio dressing is brilliant. You've got these little subtle little things of the logos sort of painted on things, the Dalek logos and things.
The sets are beautifully done. Yeah.
I never saw a real explanation for that Dalek logo, except it appeared to be a Dalek logo because it ended up on the Robomen's shirts and stuff too. But I liked it.
And of course, we see the sign vetoed on quite a lot of things around as well.
Yes.
Which reminded me a little bit of the Harold Saxon thing. There was lots of, not necessarily because it said vetoed, it's just that the posters and the little subtle things that they had on the walls and behind people in scenes, you know.
But that logo showed up on a lot of shirts, And I just wondered, for people who are now robo-sized, who don't care about what they've got on, when did they get those shirts and put them on?
Yeah. Anyway, so
well, they're all in the movie. They're all dressed in shiny plastic jumpsuits.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. It looks utterly ridiculous.
Yes.
And, there's another.
Although
there's
the helmets. Go ahead.
Well, there's also a scene later in the film when Bernard Cribbins, whose character is taking the place of Ian, is also trying to blend in with a bunch of them, and it's either funny or cringeworthy depending on what mood you're in.
Yes. Although I like the Robo-Men's helmets in the movie better than the Robo-Men's helmets in the story.
Yeah. Well, they had the budget to actually do them properly there. The same thing with the Dalek saucer as well.
The Dalek saucer, yes. Although I do agree with you, Matthew, when I watched with the new CGI, the saucer was much better.
Yeah.
Anyway, the episode ends with the iconic shot of the Dalek coming out of the water, which is fantastic. Looks really, really good.
I didn't know they never mind.
You didn't know that never mind.
I was going to make a joke, but never mind.
That's unusual. So the Doctor and Ian are sort of taken by the Robomen and the Daleks. The Doctor's great in these scenes. That's William Hartnell, by the way. The way he sort of interacts with the Daleks. Moody Tyler is sort of being moody among the very large group of extras in this early part of the thing. And what made me laugh is Dortmund makes his silver Belm, which rather reminded me of the Belm in the Pink Panther films.
Yes!
but silver. Yeah.
And people wonder sometimes why I pronounce Bim like that.
Belm.
Bim, yes.
And of course, the heliport thing, which is obviously where the saucers landed, the wobbly saucer, which I forgot to mention just a minute ago.
Yeah, the saucers from below look like Reese's cups.
Oh, do they? Oh, yeah. I thought you said Reese's cups.
No.
I've never seen Reese's cups before.
Don't take me there, Adam. Don't take me there. Okay.
But yeah, so it's quite funny the fact that this heliport thing, which seemed to be the centre of everything, reminded me a little bit of we were talking about the Ark last week and the security kitchen. What I did like about the interior,
I still haven't seen the Ark.
I'm sorry, I didn't give. There was no spoilers. Anyway, what I did like about the interior of this Dalek saucer was the round shaped TV screen that it had. And that looked really, really good. I don't know if that's an actual TV behind there, but it normally when, you know, they had a TV screen, I think it is actually, you can just see a bit of distortion on the image. But that looks really, really good.
They probably did it the same way they did the round TVs in The Invasion.
Yes.
Which was to put a TV behind a round cutout.
Yeah, but I mean,
yeah,
it looks really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like
the burned kind of edge looks cool.
Yes, it's really good. And of course, the only thing about that, of course, there's lots of people get done in. And you do notice at this point that the Daleks are not saying exterminate, or they do later on in the story, but they're just saying kill them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I double-checked. They do not say exterminate until episode five,
yes.
Yeah. It is, as Nicholas Briggs talks about on the extras for when Big Finish adapted the Curse of the Dalek stage play, which was done a year after this, that the Dalek shouting exterminate was something that the press came up with that only really comes into the TV show after the Daleks come back in 1972 in Day of the Daleks, which we'll be reviewing in a few weeks' time. They didn't really say it that much. It wasn't really a catchphrase. It was something that the press in the UK gave to them. And so that it, you know, became so ingrained. It's a bit like Beam Me Up, Scotty. It's something that never was actually said, but eventually worked its way into the culture, eventually worked its way into the show.
Yeah, exactly. My slider's stuck. Oh, dear. Sliders, that was a good series, wasn't it? I used to like that.
It for the Paul McGann TV movie not going to series in the US.
Sliders are still a good series. Anyway, the Doctor finds this little key inside this sort of Perspex box, and I thought, why? He must have worked out that was there for a specific reason, some sort of test, but he didn't, because, of course, he gets them out, and they get immediately arrested, and they say they're going to turn the Doctor into a robo-man, and so, therefore, therefore ends episode two.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the interior of the saucer is very odd in that, you know, the rebels have just walked in. Everybody's talking. They're walking around, and on the other side of a wall, and right next to a Dalek, you know, it's all going on right behind them. And it's like, how do you not notice this?
Yeah, and of course, so we all know in hindsight that the reason why William Hartnell isn't in episode four, was it three?
Four.
Yeah, it's because he got injured filming episode three. Now, I was trying to find the bit where he got injured, but I can't see it anywhere.
It's not in the show. It was during the camera rehearsal for the show, and I'm trying to think of the character now who was bringing him down. And Richard Martin, the director, tells the story on the commentary that they got to this particular actor, as I said, whose name escapes me at the moment, got to the end of the ramp and couldn't straighten his legs and just went straight into the camera. Hartnell wasn't severely hurt, but it was enough. They took him for safety's sake. They took him to the he was taken to hospital and they put him out of action for a week, which necessitated just a little bit of rewriting and bringing in somebody to double him for a very brief scene at the beginning of episode four.
But obviously, we see that scene of him being carted down the ramp. Obviously, that must have been filmed after he was injured.
Yeah, and he's not carrying him there. If you notice, he's sort of
half walking him.
Yeah.
Because he is, in the rest of that episode. Well,
yeah.
Some of it, at least. That, therefore, turns Ian into the superhero, action hero, I should say, of the rest of this story. And, of course, it's episode four, was it three? Three, where Susan and David start striking up a bit of a romance. And unlike the Leela romance in her last story, this is a bit more believable for me, although
it is
a little bit old for her, but you can see that she's looking up to him and he's clearly got affection for her, and this is, I have to say, if Susan had been portrayed like this for the rest of her time in the show, I think I might have found her a bit more bearable, because I really do like her in this story. It's a shame, isn't it? Anyway, back to
Not all talk at once. Yes, I agree. This episode three is the one with the great shots around London.
Yeah, the chasing.
Yes. And love all of that.
Running, yes. Pushing a wheelchair. The health and safety nowadays wouldn't allow that sort of thing.
Well, this is when I was talking about on Facebook that you could take sections of this story. You could take the Daleks out. You could put in the Nazis.
Absolutely.
And you could set it in kind of this alternate present day where, you know, the Nazis have occupied Britain for 20 years. And this is the point where I was really talking about. You can see them going around London in one point. They've even got the sucker arms up in the air in the style of the Daleks. Yep. Not the Daleks, the Nazi salute. You can tell I've had 4 hours sleep.
You can tell I'm drinking some Heineken at the moment. Very nice it is too.
So, you know, and it's, I think, clear there, and I think that's also the business about putting up signs that we talked about, all the Dalek writing all over the place and the vetoed as well.
Yeah.
It's the sense that as the line said from Army of Ghosts says, this isn't an invasion, it's an occupation. The invasion's already come and gone. It's dealing with the aftermath of it and trying to survive through it.
Yeah.
Well, at one point, when I saw these scenes, the thought that occurred to me was, the Daleks were just as impressed with London's major sites as tourists are, so maybe they were just being tourists in all of these places.
At one point, they run in front of the Royal Albert Hall. I wonder if the problems, Doctor Who problems, is going on at that time.
Anyway, there was a funny scene.
Matthew, you complain about 4 hours of sleep. Most Mondays, I've only had 4 hours of sleep.
For those of us who didn't get a lot of sleep.
Excuse me, it's not touche. A competition. Okay.
No wagering.
No. Anyway, right. So there was a funny scene in which the Daleks entered their little sort of place where that vehicle they were putting together. This is later on, obviously, and they sort of just try talking to the dummy that was in there.
Yes.
Dortmund decides he's going to commit suicide. Basically, he's made another Belm. And the only way of testing this Belm is by going out there and getting himself killed by the Daleks and throwing it at them. Didn't really have that much of an effect on them, but really, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And then Barbara makes a curious statement at some point where she says, You know, we have to be grateful to him because he allowed, you know, by doing that, he allowed us to live. And I'm thinking, well, if he hadn't run out there, you know, yelling, oi, oi, you know, Daleks, look at me. I'm going to throw a bomb at you. The Daleks may not have known they were even there.
Well, I think there's a sense with that sequence of them being pursued and that the Daleks are certainly aware something's going on because of the Resistance having launched that futile attack earlier in the episode. So I may be reading too much into it.
There's one funny scene where they inside the saucer, Ian and the other guy are in the storage compartment. And they push up, they do the Star Wars A New Hope thing where they push up to climb out. And the camera comes up and you clearly see the opening. It's all, they could have just gone out and up around the side. It was just not blocked well with the camera. It looks funny.
Yeah. And when Ian says that he's hiding out in the ramp housing, when they start to lower the ramp, I'm thinking, oh, that's going to kill him because he's in the ramp housing. But apparently it has no effect at all.
No, clearly not. Anyway, back to the story. I've lost my place. So the end of episode 3 is, a bigger bum gets put down. And it's a really interesting ticking noise it's got. Which reminds me a little bit of Trumpton, I think it was, had a similar clock that had the...
Yeah.
Now in this story they don't use rels, but by the movie of this story they started using rels for Dalek time.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
The movie's only what, 2 years later?
Yeah.
So the Doctor then, as we say, collapses, and therefore obviously David is the one that in this version of it works a way of disarming the bomb. It was had a rubbish detonator, it's got to be said. The fact that all you have to do is pour acid on it and then bash it with a stick.
Well, then he pulls the detonator out of it as well, which actually is not that implausible, because that was actually how, particularly in the 70s and 80s, that was how a lot of the nuclear weapons were designed.
Yeah, not designed.
Was that you put the explosive charge in, then you pull, you know, you can take it back out again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's not implausible. The polystyrene, on the other hand, that the bomb is made out of.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of, Fred liked how it melted like that.
I like that side of things. I just thought it was a bit funny that the fact that, that he bashed it with a stick. It's a great big powerful bomb. But anyway, and also never mind. So basically what I was trying to allude to is the fact that David's done this, and you can tell quite clearly the Doctor would have been the one that would have actually done all that if he'd been comprehendous for this episode. So meanwhile, Barbara is pretty awesome, setting herself up for driving that truck thing. And Ian and Larry have arrived in Bedfordshire, and there's lots of a very large amount of extras pulling a truck along a railway.
Actually, it's Kent. I know what they say Bedfordshire, but it's John's whole quarry in Kent.
How about we just forget all this blab about Bedfordshire?
Yeah, never mind. Now, did you notice that one of the Robomen had been in the previous story that we reviewed?
No.
He was one of the Erps.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, he was indeed. Wasn't the Erp that got killed? I can't remember now.
I think so.
I think he was. So Chuck with the big ears. He used to be in a comedy series called... what was it called again? It was about the shop. Department store. Grace Brothers.
Are you being surfed?
That's the one, yeah. He was in that for many years.
Oh.
And, of course, there was quite a nice little scene. As Barbara drives a truck out of the thing, that the body of Dortmund is sort of still lying there in the street. Nice little continuity touch there. Mm. And she's awesome, isn't she? Driving through the Daleks. That was great.
Yes.
Daleks, those particular Daleks, not very good shots, unfortunately. You would have thought that... they would be more than a match for a moving truck, but obviously not on this occasion.
Well, it's a very large truck.
Yeah, well, you get the impression from some of the dialogue and stuff through this, and this may go back to the easily disarmed bomb, that the Daleks just assume there's not going to – assume, you know, they've conquered the Earth. They've got most – you know, they've got everybody. They're not expecting a whole lot of resistance.
And they think they think the humans are stupid, basically.
Yeah, well, I get the impression that the last thing the Daleks are expecting is somebody's going to go barreling through them with a truck.
Yeah.
And anyway. The Daleks appear to be very lightweight.
Yes.
Because in that scene when they all rebel, you know, I mean, they're just lifting those Daleks right up like they don't weigh anything. Yeah. And the way the truck smashes right through them, I'm thinking these Daleks are not very, you know, heavy or armored.
Well, well, the actors had to pick them up and the thing had to easily come apart when they hit the thing with the truck because they probably couldn't afford to pay for the truck to get repaired.
Yep, that's that too. Anyway, I love the bit where I think they meet up with Ashton in this sort of little hut thing. And Ian, and I love it when he's being tough. He just stands there talking in a slightly deeper sort of voice. That Ian being tough is just so excellent. And then
Fred was disappointed that there wasn't a whole lot with the slither. She liked the slither.
No, somebody's
and
got
the slither was rather easily destroyed with just a rock.
Should we mention who played the Ashton character in the movie version of this?
You can do.
Philip Maddock in his first Doctor Who role.
Yes, it was. Yes, well done. I remember now. Anyway, so meanwhile, Susan's in the sewers and the ladder she's climbing on sort of falls backwards and there's an alligator. Well, should we say baby alligator in the, in the sewers. I do like the way they sort of explain this.
Yeah, well, you think they could have found a better piece of stock footage for the alligator.
But she gets rescued, I think, by Tyler, if I remember rightly, in that particular thing. And you're so right about the slither.
David and Tyler.
Yeah.
I got so confused with the names of everyone that other than David, I couldn't tell you who was who.
I was quite happy with the character
names. They all looked alike and sounded alike.
That's where you follow. It's when watching a story multiple times helps. Of course, I've had this DVD for ages, but
yeah, this was the first time I'd ever watched more than the first few minutes. I've only seen it. Before, when I first got the DVD, I watched it up until Susan twisted her ankle, and that was it. I'm going, oh, God, Susan's twisted her ankle again, and didn't watch it until this past week. And unfortunately, I was only able to watch it 1.5 times. That's my excuse of the week.
Okay. All right, we've got you down for that.
like you said earlier on, the slither gets done in quite easily, but that allows Ian and Larry to descend to the sort of lower levels of the mine. Meanwhile, David and the Doctor and Susan are sort of battling their way past Robomen to meet up with Tyler. And eventually, it's everybody's heading for Bedford, but some people are a bit slower than others. Meanwhile, Barbara and... what's her name again? The woman she's Jenny. Barbara and Jenny. Meet a couple
of... Who potentially could have been the next companion.
She could have been, yes.
Yeah, before Maureen O'Brien was cast as Vicky, they were seriously considering Jenny as Susan's replacement.
Yeah, I think that would have worked quite well. But they meet up with a couple of hags, or sort of.
Well, do we
crones.
Know why it didn't? Why it did not happen?
I'm sure that you can tell us, Matthew.
Well, it is kind of talked about briefly.
Take it away, Matthew.
On the DVD commentary, but also on the net, what would have been the next story in sequence, The Rescue, as well. I think they really wanted another young identification figure, which Jenny isn't quite that character. And in some respects, I think you could argue, as one of my fellow fanzine writers has, that the Vicky character is what Susan should have been to begin with, but it took them 2 attempts to get it right. And also the fact that Carol Ann Ford has said, as we were saying, as I think you said earlier, Adam, that had Susan been written this well and this way, you know, throughout the rest of when she'd been playing the part previously, she'd have stayed on the show. But she left because she was very dissatisfied with the constantly twisting her ankle and the yelling and the screaming. Yeah. So... Mm-hmm.
And they make her twist her ankle in this story too. Anyway, like I said,
this is her final story, so they had to do it one more time for old time's sake.
Yeah, clearly.
One for the road.
This was the first episode of this was only 2 days before the first anniversary.
Yeah,
of the show.
There you go. Anyway,
and they were already doing sequel stories at that point.
Yes.
There we go. Anyway, Susan and Jenny and Barbara are turned into the Daleks. By the very kind crone, who's, I suppose, it's her daughter that's gone off to to blab to them.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to what I was talking about, and sort of you can make the analogy to a Britain occupied by the Nazis, in that in Ashton you have the black marketeers, the people who took advantage of the situation, and also you have the women in the woods, as they're credited as they're said in the credits, who are collaborators. They're helping the Daleks out, and you know, the first time somebody shows up for help, they hand them in simply because mm-hmm. you know they think they'll be better off for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so just to even things out, Larry hurts his knee, I think, while climbing out of the little mining sort of truck thing. And then he meets his brother. Aww.
Conveniently, yes.
His brother is a Roboman. Aww.
Well, they've spent an episode or so beforehand saying, I'm going up there to meet my brother, or to find my brother. So it's Chekhov's gun, is as they put it in dramatic terms. Yeah. You set something up, you better use it. And, I think it's a good, it's convenient, yes, but I think the scene works rather well, and it does invoke that. Mm-hmm. Another cliche of the resistance occupied genre. Yes.
Go ahead. Are wicker baskets exactly useful for carrying rocks?
I wondered about that too. I'm thinking, boy, they're not going to last. Or the rocks they're carrying can't be very heavy.
They were styrofoam.
Yeah, well, they do comments about that. I think Ian and Larry, when they're talking, and it's like, this seems like very odd mining equipment. It's basically the Daleks don't care as long as the job gets done. You know, it's the humans doing the work. But it wicker baskets for mining does seem quite odd.
Yes.
Anyway, right. So
then we have the scene, the campfire scene where Susan and David finally
have a kissy-kissy. Lovely.
Yes, kiss. Oh, yeah. Snogging.
Lovely.
See, companions were kissing well before 2005, everybody. Yeah.
And this is far, far more appropriate. And,
but they weren't kissing the doctor.
Exactly.
That is true.
Anyway, Ian manages to get himself trapped in the container that contains the explosives that the Dalek is going to use to sort of finally penetrate the...
Yes!
Which I think it's quite funny. Or just hide here. Oh, bugger.
Although he does, I'm surprised they were able to get it working again later because of all the damage he was doing by pulling wires out.
Yeah, he was having a great time
wires
pulling
out
those
left,
wires.
Right, ripping wires out left, right, and center.
Yeah, that was quite funny, I thought. But I thought, you know, they did a fairly good job with the models they used for that particular thing. Apart from the Ian falling down the tube bit later on in the next episode was quite funny. But yes, I thought, you know, they tried their best, and I thought they did quite a good job at that for that particular era. I think this a lot of money would seem to have been thrown at this particular story.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, this was the final story of the first production block that had started all the way in September 1963 with An Unearthly Child. This was the very end of the recording block, though this was, in fact, the second story of the second season. So it was the end of the season, but they had put money back so that they could do it and, you know, to do the location filming and also to do, as we've talked about, some bottle work, which in some places is excellent, and in some places, thank God, they went and did CGI versions.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, though. When
I didn't get as far as this episode for the CGI version. I'll go back and watch it later.
They didn't. The CGI version only, the CGI work is only really done of the Battersea Power Station shot in the first episode and also the various saucer shots in parts 1 through 4. After that, there's no more CGI effects. I imagine it was, they probably either spent the budget for the effects at that point, or it was just a case of that's just going to be too difficult to replace.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
It's kind of a shame, though.
Yeah. So basically, when Barbara and Jenny reach the sort of Dalek bridge, I suppose you'd call it, Barbara is absolutely superb in those scenes. And, of course, the Doctor and Tyler and Susan and David arrive, and the Doctor then sends Susan and David down and asks them not to pick daisies on the way. I thought that was quite an amusing line. Ian arrives at the other end of the bomb shaft and uses some twigs. All right, then. Some sort of wood.
It's shoring timber.
Yeah, to sort of block the passage of the explosive.
Isn't as implausible as the first time I watched it, I thought it was really bizarre that they were using it there. But if you go back to the mine scenes, and they're using that same material to shore up the walls of the mine, and
exactly.
It's like,
And there's a very iconic scene of the Doctor from the Daleks' viewpoint as well.
Yes.
You just see the Dalek sucker and it zooming in on the Doctor. That's fantastic. And then Barbara comes up with the idea of giving the Robomen the countermands to kill the Daleks. And then it basically a great big volcanic eruption, which they're just next to, goes off.
Yeah.
Well, presumably they've gotten a bit farther away than it's implied. Once again, you know, poor choice of stock footage.
They would have to have got a blimmin' light way further than they actually did.
That was massively destructive. Yes.
Yes. Could have been better done.
It reminded me of the sort of destruction you would have got in Inferno. You know, that they were implying the sort of same sort of thing was going on there, but never mind. Continuity didn't really matter much in Doctor Who in those days. So, and then, of course, that leaves us 10 minutes, the end of the story, for the big farewell, and it was done absolutely brilliantly, the farewell scene for Susan. It's one of the, and probably is, probably the, in my view, best farewell scene in the history of Doctor Who. Because the build-up, the acting between the helpless David, that the fact that doors have been locked, Hartnell, fantastic. The delivery of that speech and the sadness, the music was amazing. All round, it just brought a lump to my throat. Every time I watch that, I have to watch it. It's not one of those things that, I mean, at that time I was watching it the other morning, that Alicia and Isabella and Deb were sort of being a bit noisy, and I really wanted to watch it and enjoy it. And that's one scene I can watch. Just forget the rest of the story, just watch the last 10 minutes. Not saying the rest of the story is not brilliant, but that scene is one of the best scenes in the history of Doctor Who.
Yes. So you would rank that over the David Tennant,
Rose,
Billy Piper goodbye when she's in the alternate universe.
Yeah, because it's between the Doctor and his own flesh and blood, his own granddaughter, and it's more, has more impact because he's got to separate himself from his own flesh and blood. It's not somebody. The Doctor and Rose. It's just it's a love that shouldn't be in some ways. It's moving, but this one it has more impact because it's between the Doctor and his own flesh and blood. We don't see any of the Doctor's other family and for the rest of Doctor Who, and
more so than the 11th Doctor and Amy when was the first face he saw.
Yeah,
huh?
Again,
you'd rank it over all that,
definitely. Because even though that is a moving scene, that this scene ranks well above any of that stuff that they've done since. Even the Sarah Jane departure scene, which is lovely and moving, this scene is the best companion departure. So therefore, right, who can we start with on the who do we, what do we think of this story? I think we'll save the best till last. That's you, by the way, Mary. We'll start with Matthew.
Thank you.
Well, Adam, are you not going to give us your thoughts on what you thought of this story?
I love it. I think it's fantastic. It's certainly better than its predecessor. I still maintain it could be a little bit shorter. A certain padding I enjoyed, not the the exterior scenes of London, but there was other bits of padding which seemed to be sort of repeating the same thing, same sort of scenes. There were some very similar scenes going on, which a little bit boring. I think they could have probably lost one episode's worth. I think the five episodes would have probably been about right for this one.
And it would have tightened it up some for you?
Just a little bit. But having said that, it's still really, really good. I think it's a fantastic, brilliant, well acted. It's not quite as dark as other Dalek stories, but it's compelling, and it keeps you glued to it. It didn't sort of seem like a six-parter to me in some ways, because I quite enjoyed watching it. The episodes raced along. There was plenty going on, plenty of dialogue, good acting. It was pretty to watch. The music it was about right. There was quite a lot of different types of music in this story. But for its time, I think it's one of the best scores that they've had, certainly in this part of the Hartnell era of Doctor Who. So, it's one of the best. It's not my favourite Hartnell story, but it's one of the best. Matthew?
Well, this is my favorite Hartnell, at least of what survives. Though I would say that the Ark in particular comes probably a very close second.
Obviously,
I agree with you.
Get the Ark and see it.
Oh, the Ark!
All you guys keep going on about the Ark.
The Ark is severely underrated.
Yeah, that's what Noah thought.
I do agree with you, though. I think it could have been tightened up a bit. I think it would have been, like most six-parters, it would have been a even better five-parter and would have been a cracking good four-parter, though I would have hated to have lost some of the shots, particularly in episode 3 of them going across London. It's a story that, as I've said both on Facebook and throughout this episode, that you could really – we talk about the fact, as we did with Genesis of the Daleks, that the Daleks, to a certain extent, owe their existence to the Nazis. And I think this story is probably where that's most apparent. As I said, for huge chunks of the story, you can take out the Daleks and you could put in the Nazis and stuff with the occupation. And there's echoes of what they did when they occupied countries in Europe and what was also being planned for their occupation of Britain. And we now know far more detail about that than Terry Nation would have known when this was written in 1964. Stuff like the street signs, for example, being replaced with signs in the Dalek language. The Germans did very similar things. As you said, Mary, the Germans didn't have Robomen, but the Germans were good about going into countries and setting up, taking basically the already existing law enforcement that was already there and converting it into local branches of the SS and the Gestapo, which you could look at as being done with the Robomen. They're brainwashed. They're doing the Dalek's orders. And I think that there is also, as I said, you've got collaborators, black marketeers, you've got the resistance, and some wonderful shots that I think are interesting pre-echoes of another film about resistance, the Battle of Algiers, which wasn't released for another year or two after this came out, was originally shown, and there's no way that the people making that could have seen it, but there's some interesting pre-echoes of it. There's really good performances in this story as well. I think that the entire regular cast gets plenty of things to do. And as we've said, this is probably Susan's best story since An Unearthly Child. It's a shame that she couldn't have been written this well for the rest of in the stories in between, and Carol Ann Ford certainly would have wanted to stay longer. There's a really good supporting cast. I particularly liked Alan Judd as is it Dortmund? I can never pronounce his name correctly. The leader of the resistance, who you get that wonderful Churchillian speech that he gives, and of course he's stuck in a wheelchair, possibly a la FDR. So it's like a combination of the two great wartime leaders. And, of course, the Daleks are put to great effect, I think, as well. I think if you can excuse some of the issues of its age, particularly some sets design that doesn't quite make sense because they're packing a studio and, of course, the effects. But as I've said before, I'm always willing to forgive over-ambition over under-ambition in trying to tart something up. And I think this is – as a result of that, it's one of the most ambitious stories from this period. And, of course, the Hartnell era is the period of the show when they were being very experimental, finding out what can we possibly do with Doctor Who and discovering what you can and can't do in a TV studio. And I applaud them for that.
Thank you very much. Kirby.
Yes. Sorry about that. I was plugging a phone in.
You're listening intently to Matthew's comments there.
Oh, I was listening intently to Matthew's. And mine's going to be pretty short because this is the first time I've seen this, and this was good. So far, until I see this fabulous arc that everyone has been going on and on about, this is my favorite Hartnell. It's just good from beginning to end. I didn't mind the usual wobbly set stuff because that just happened. Just some really fantastic, iconic things going on. The London chase and the end, Susan's leaving. I'd never seen more than just the little section of the Doctor's speech that we saw at the beginning of The Five Doctors. I'd never seen the rest of that scene. And to fit that into context, how moving.
Yeah, exactly.
just oh wow.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my point.
I'm done.
Mary.
Mm-hmm. Well, of the Hartnell stories that I've seen so far, this is definitely my favorite. And as we've talked about, there are just a lot of, you know, funny little glitchy things that, you know, we can be amused with. But they didn't take away from the overall power of the story. In fact, I failed to mention that when we were talking about episode four, when the doctor and one of the other rebels were on the ship and the Daleks are and they're hiding on either side of a doorway, the Daleks are all exiting. And because their eye stalks only see ahead, they're not seeing him, except the last Dalek's eye stalk was turned definitely sideways.
Yes.
And would have taken full, you know, shot of the doctor on his way out. But, you know, those are the kind of things that make this both amusing, but don't take away from the power of the story. And what for me, the most powerful part of the story, was their chase across London, that intense drumming soundtrack really added to the tension and the power of their, you know, of their plight. And of course, this is also when we're seeing the Daleks in all the major places in London. And while and the Barbara, you know, pushing Dortmund's wheelchair. And it was, for me, the most engaging scene of the entire series. And of course, I'm a woman, so I noticed the clothes. And I noticed that Barbara doesn't get dirty at all, in spite of all the stuff she does.
And how
until
does she
about,
keep her, how does she keep her hair so perfect?
And her hair, yes, yeah. I was going to mention her hair. She always looks like she just stepped out of the beauty salon, in spite of, you know, running clear across London and you know, running through, you know, dirty places. And when she is mussed, it looks, you know, very organized mussed and sprayed in place, which is a little unfortunate. And Ian, ever the gentleman, he's always in his suit and he's always adjusting his tie.
He did get a bit of a rip down the back at one point.
At the very end, he's got a rip down the back of his jacket, which I think was probably unintended, because from the rest of that last episode, he never turns around. So you can't see that, you know, the rip might still or might not be there. But I took great amusement in that. And the Jenny character, in spite of everybody being dirty and worn and ripped and, you know, generally very old looking, she went around in a shirt that looked like brand new and very stiff for all of her scenes, and she never seemed to get dirty either.
That hood that she was wearing or whatever,
she looked very Islamic with that hood on. And so I thought, ooh, this is an Islamic character. This will be interesting. But then it was gone, and, you know, then it would be back on, and then it would be gone. So I don't know that it had any relevance at all to who she was as a character.
Probably not.
Probably not, yeah. Outside of the amusing little spots and loving that chase through London, I loved this story.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm so glad to hear that one, Mary. Be interesting to find out eventually what Robert, and probably not Reese, I don't expect Reese watched it, thought of it.
Hi, this is Fraser Hines, and you're listening to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
So I suppose we could, we got some feedback, you know.
Ooh.
Whether I can actually get it up or not. I mean, the feedback, that is, good grief.
That's what she said.
Well, good afternoon, 20 Megabyters. Andy in here, 20 plus 5 on Sunday afternoon. I'm sitting here, I've got a glass of wine, not normally a Sunday, but I'm not working tomorrow. I'm celebrating the fact that England have beaten the special interest sheet people by 29 points to 18 at rugby. Excellent. Very good game, and Dawn was having to quiet down. I think it's short, I might frighten the neighbours. But also, we both did the Guildford Half Marathon today, and I went round in 1:59.01, which is my fastest time since I tore my hamstring about 3 years ago, and beat Dawn, who did 1:59.32. So not personal best for either of us, but only about a minute or so outside of it. But, oh my God, I got to 12 miles, and it was hurting. I still managed to, well, I would call it a sprint finish, more like I managed to break into an amble when I finished at the Guildford City Football Club, when you went round the track and finished on the halfway line. But yes, I'm very pleased with that. So this morning's challenge being running 13 miles, this afternoon's challenge is going up and down stairs.
Oh,
bits
yes.
of me do not want to bend.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dalek Invasion of Earth, excellent story. I mean, it's, yeah, for 1965, obviously, you can't expect from the special effects. I know you can look at the redone things here as well, but I looked at the original version. That was much, massively cleaned up, and the lovely Dawn did watch bits of it and commented how good it was for a story. This is nearly 50 years old. And it's a good story. You can see what the Daleks are trying to do. I mean, you know, they obviously want to drive this planet round and turn it into a motorised planet because they've lost all their own bases and use it to attack the rest of the universe. So they're going to blow the core. The only trouble is an explosion. Where does everything go? Yeah, that's the only thing Flora can find. You know, you sort of you blow the core out of the Earth. It's actually got to go somewhere, and if it's going to go outwards, it's going to take the rest of the planet with it. So that's the only slight flaw in it. But I thought actually, I mean, it was a very good episode, a very good story. I beg your pardon. There's some wonderful moments of going around London, because a lot of where it was filmed is actually close to where I work. When they were doing the chase scene where Scary Hair, Barbara, God, that hair is scary, and Jenny were taking Dortmund and his wheelchair, a lot of where they were going is actually where I do my regular running around London. So it's interesting to see how much of that is still the same, yet how much of it has changed. I mean, they go across the bridge, that's one of the bridges I regularly run across and have cycled across the time. And when they're carrying it down, there's some on the side. I thought, yeah, that's it. I know that place. We seem to see, you know, what the buildings have gone. And you think, you know, compare London to what it was 50 years ago. If you watch something like Randall and Hopgood, the original series, you get the same sort of thing. Sorry, I am going slightly off it. I thought the music for that little running scene when they're running along trying to push the wheelchair. One thing about Jenny, why does she have to wear that bloody stupid hat on all the time? You know, it's yeah, she didn't seem to do it. Now, it's interesting because each of the characters came into their own at different points of it. I think with six parts of one, I'm guessing one episode, Bill Hartnell was on holiday because he was there at the beginning and that was it, and you never saw him again. I assume that given the fact they were filming this virtually the whole of the year, you know, they have got to give the actors a break some point in time. So they can write a lot of episodes by, you know, filming some of the week before to have them in, and they can disappear off for a week. So that explained that. But at various points, it was the Doctor was in charge, at the point Ian was in charge. Barbara, they sort of listened to. Susan, well, sort of became the love interest for David. And then you've got people like Tyler, and you've got David Campbell, who at different points in time were taken over. Now, I got slightly confused when they brought on the Black Marketeer, Ashton, and I think, oh, it'd be Philip Maddock. And of course, now that's the film, wasn't it? You know, that's me getting confused. I watched it over about 3 or 4 days at different stages during the day, and for some reason I expected to see Philip Maddock there as well. The Slytherin. Oh, dear God. That was bloody awful in the middle of the Slytherin, actually. I did wonder if they were actually saying Slytherin, but, I mean, it really was dreadful, that, wasn't it? And the way Ian managed to stop a large canister with a bomb by sticking basically a couple of Twiglets across the thing, you know, and he said, he put two across, or was it three? And leads to that, you thought, well, hang on a minute, there's about 4 or 5 more props against the wall. Why don't you make sure you've done the job properly, stick the whole lot across it there, and then it will actually make sure it does stop the damn thing, because, to be honest, you know, if something gets dropped down, if there's a bit of momentum going, it's going to go through those things, isn't it? So, well, yeah. Also, the Daleks. I think I've got some Vitus dance or something, because they never blooming keep still, do they? I mean, at one point, they were actually, I think it was the end of episode 3, when they got the Doctor strapped to the table, and they talk to each other, they keep bumping into each other, you know, and someone wants to say, stop moving and smacking me over the... Exactly. I know you got the thing you can try and work out, which I was talking, you've got the lights flashing and things like that, but it's all the way through, they always had to keep moving, didn't they? It wasn't the same as you've got now, where they'll just, the eye stalk will move, or the headpiece will rotate. So that's it. And also, another thing, the number of times you see shadows of camera crew and things like that, the one that really stood out for me was when Dortmund leaves the museum and goes off to attack the Daleks by himself. You quite clearly see on the right-hand side of the picture, there is the shadow of what I presume is a camera crew moving across. And it's 2 or 3 times that they did that. So, I mean, I guess this is, they've only got one take, and they've got to go for it, haven't they? But I think what this is, it's really good social commentary on, you know, when a nation, a race, a whole planet could be subjugated, who are going to be the ones who are going to just roll over and die? Who are the ones who are going to fight back? And who are the ones like the Black Lives Matter who are going to try and turn it to their own advantage? So that you saw all of humanity in that, in those different roles. And you saw someone like David Cameron. Good grief. One of my heroes, but yeah, that's the thing. David Campbell, who wanted to take it one way, and Tyler, who's going to take it the other way. It would be interesting to see who actually end up leading and how they manage it, and given the fact that with the plague and things like that, you know, what's the population of the Earth like now? And it would have been probably about between 4 and 5 billion at the time. Well, the time it was made, I suppose. I mean, what is it now? 6-7 billion, is it now? Wouldn't be quite so much. But how many of those people would have survived? And the little extra on the DVD, I didn't listen to it off that because I've heard it before, is the Whatever Happened to Doctor Who's Granddaughter Susan. Now, this is something that they did on BBC Radio 7, it's now called 4 Extras, where the internet-only station, where they did, you know, it's what's happened to Billy Bunter and what happened to people like that, and they did that one. And if you listen to it, it's actually a delight, because basically, she hated the fact she got dumped there in the middle of this planet that's got no future, or possibly hasn't got a future, and everything's falling apart. And what she ends up doing, and she ends up becoming a worker for the United Nations. And it's well worth a visit, a listen. It's really, really very funny, so I can thoroughly recommend that to you. But I suppose if you think of this story for one thing, it will be the final speech by the Doctor. Now, this is the first time that we've actually written out a companion, so it's groundbreaking, and for a lot of people, I think the first time they've seen that speech would have been when it was used to the very beginning of Five Doctors. And it is quite moving, because, you know, there's his granddaughter, he can see what's going on. You're a woman now, she's falling over with a man, she wants to go off with him, and Susan's, Gordon Bennett, I'm getting it wrong, Barbara, scary hair, spots it. Ian, of course, many people bloke, hasn't got a clue what's going on, so yesterday two attempts to get dragged off into the TARDIS before he understands what's going on. But I think, again, that is one of the classic moments of Doctor Who, and it's one of those speeches that has been redone. I think it got reprised, actually, during the 50th anniversary. I think David Bradley actually redid that one as well. So all in all, very enjoyable story. There's a lot to it. Yeah, the special effects, you say, weren't brilliant, but, you know, you're talking about what they could do at the time. But all in all, very enjoyable. And Deanna Swee was robbed. Be seeing you.
That was Andy Dunny. And thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome onto the show Mr. Robert Haynes. And I can hear myself coming back.
Yes.
So was that echo, echo. Sorry, the microphone lead slipped. My one was going to be, you deserve a jolly good smack bottom.
Yes.
Very, very nice. Good choice. Can I touch on a couple of points of Andy's feedback before we move on?
Yes, of course.
Touch on those smack bottom.
Yes.
Well, just a couple of points that Andy brought up. Also, the big problem.
Carry on.
One day, I will think of something else to say. Yes, I will think of something else to say. Until then, there must be no tears, no regrets, no anxieties.
You must go forward in all your beliefs.
Yes.
And prove to me that I can avoid strangling my co-hosts. Anyways, well, back to the more serious points I was attempting to make. The business about the magnetic core has kind of been retconned in a couple of places. One of the Virgin New Adventures, God Engine, touches upon the issue as well as a couple of the Big Finish audios. I think towards the end of their Eighth Doctor Adventures run, which features another Dalek invasion of Earth, which brings me to the other point, which was whatever happened to Susan. The thing he mentions was I think was originally a Radio 4 comedy piece broadcast in the early 90s, and it is available, as he says, as an extra on the DVD. There's also a couple of more, shall we say, more serious attempts at doing it, both featuring the Eighth Doctor. The first is one of the Eighth Doctor novels from the BBC, Legacy of the Daleks by John Peel. And Big Finish has also touched upon it as well, in their Eighth Doctor adventures, starting with An Earthly Child, which is set about 20 years after the events at the end of the story, and also introduces.
I heard that one.
Yeah, also introduces the Doctor's great grandson, Alex Campbell, who's played by Paul McGann's own son, Jake McGann. So, Yes, the audios are well worth seeking out. I haven't read Legacy, though I own it, though it does have a reputation for not being one of the better books.
Okay. What? Something of Doctor Who you have not consumed?
Well, you could talk, Kirby.
Is it possible there is something on the face of the earth that you have that has to do with Doctor Who that you haven't touched?
I have a lot of knowledge, but doesn't mean I've experienced everything.
Okay, well, anyway. So, Robert, so before we move on to the next bit of feedback, what did you think of Dalek Invasion of Earth?
I very much, especially after the gunfighters, it's a return to form. And one thing that I loved was the multiple location filming. I thought that really added to things, and very effective scenes of the empty streets, etc. And less said about the slither, the better. yeah, there were some good performances, and I like the way they built up David and Susan's relationship over the course of the episodes. I thought that worked well. And nice cast. Except for I kept on watching it. Like I said, it's been a while since I watched, as to whether Dortmund or Tyler were actually bad people. Dortmund obviously didn't turn up when he sacrificed his life testing his bombs, but Tyler always looked a bit shifty to me, and I was expecting him to be in league with the Daleks or something, even though I'd seen it. So that was a bit funny, but just was a serious man. But yeah, and also another thing was funny is some of the Dalek voices just seem a bit silly. You get used to the new series Daleks with, Nicholas Briggs could do a wide variety of different Daleks, high pitch, low pitch, or whatever. Some of these ones sound a bit silly, even though we had the bartender from last week doing the voices of some of the Daleks.
Yes.
Doing the low register type of Daleks, I understand.
It's interesting that ring modulation was only really used for one of the Daleks, I noticed. The rest of them were sort of seemed to be done by people's own voices.
Yeah, they had the voltage. Yeah but those had the voltage regulator or something, whatever that is.
Well, it was also because, as Nicholas Briggs has revealed, when he talked to a lot of the Dalek voices from across the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the classic series, about when he was setting up at Big Finish to get ready to do theirs, and suddenly discovered that they never actually wrote down the ring modulator settings. And that
they had the Daleks.
Yeah, and they never actually wrote down what the settings were, so they differed wildly from story to story, and sometimes, as with this story, from episode to episode.
Yeah.
And I guess
The voice of the Slither was very human-sounding, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks. Anything else, Robert? Sorry.
I was going to say...
I don't know.
I know. Yeah, just very effective. It's good to see... a nice return for him, and as I said, the outside scenes just added so much. But when you look at some of the scenes, they're a bit claustrophobic, and having those outside scenes counteracted that. So, but all in all, a very good job with good actors. So yeah, I was happy with that.
Excellent. A few of us were saying that this was our favorite Hartnell recipe. Story.
You thinking food?
What would you say? Yeah. Well, I just finished making something.
How would you cook it? Slow roast.
Yeah. what would you say?
Well, he's a bit tough, wouldn't he be at that age? So, yeah, slow roast.
I'm saying that several of us were saying this was our favorite Hartnell.
Hartnell does such a good impersonation of the Doctor, not impersonation, but he inhabits the character of the Doctor so well. And I really only appreciated that until I saw that extra on the, what's it called? Adventure in Time and Space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you see him behind the scenes getting ready for his pantomime, and that just shows you his real character, very gruff sort of man. But the Doctor, you can see the Doctor is some role that he puts on with all his and, you know, Chesterton and, you know, all these mannerisms that he puts into the character.
Yeah, he's very much got that. And this is the first Doctor comfortably. There was when it first started out, it was a bit of getting used to, but this is it doesn't deviate from this portrayal now. I mean, it's like when he's doing comedy first Doctor, he sort of has a certain way of talking, and the one that sticks in my mind is from the Time Meddler, when he's trying to explain to Stephen that he's in fact a time machine, and when they find a Viking helmet on the shore, he goes, "What do you think that is? A space helmet for a cow?" It's just so him.
Yes.
I love it. It stands up to the test of time today. Yes. And very good, very good.
Thank you. Right then, we have some feedback from Mr. M, which I have forwarded to Mary Lang to read because I can't be bothered. No offence, Mr. M, but I've just had drunk a pint of Heineken, and I think I should pass it over to somebody who is not slightly intoxicated. Mary.
Oh well, that's a mistake because I've been drinking wine during this. So,
Andy Nunny's rubbed off on you.
That's
my alcoholic beverage.
Where did you send it?
To you on your Gmail account.
That's a point.
Oh, in a Gmail. Okay. All right. Let me see if I can find it. I'm not finding a Gmail.
Didn't end up in your didn't end up in
unless
your...
I don't know where to look. I'm looking in my Gmail
inbox.
Which Gmail? Well, you only have one.
I only have one.
Yes.
Oh, good grief. I'll do it then. Hello, team. It's me, Mr. M.
Hello.
Apologies for no feedback last week, but the reason why I will be why will become really use punctuation, Mr. M, will become clear as we owe on. Also, I doubt very much there will be a feedback next week either, but that's because I'm on holiday that week. You lucky so-and-so. But here we are, beginning with my look at every Doctor Who story in order from the start. Number one, An Unearthly Child. So this is where it all began. Much has been said about this story in the 50 years since it was first broadcast, but despite the common consensus, the Caveman episodes are not as awful as some people say, and they did manage to keep my attention and interest. This was the first time I had ever properly ventured into black and white Doctor Who, and surprisingly, I almost prefer it to colour. I expected myself to have a huge trouble adjusting to the difference, not only in picture quality, but in effects, dialogue, and pacing. But I love it. Ian and Barbara, the original companions, are great, and Ian is definitely the leading man of the show in the first episodes. The idea of having both a history and science teacher is great, allowing Barbara and Ian to shine in both historical and futuristic stories respectively. Susan, however, in this story, she is incredibly interesting, mysterious, and most of all weird. But from the second episode onwards, she becomes nothing more than a normal, boring, screaming companion. And I think there's something wrong with his end key, because "and" comes out as "ad." But anyway, and you can understand why Carol Ann Ford chose to leave in the Dalek invasion of Earth. Speaking of the Daleks, number two, the Daleks. The first part is my favourite. Atmospheric, mysterious, chilling, and a cliffhanger that enthralled the nation. Story.
I've just read the book.
The story as a whole, very good. But it starts to weaken as the story continues. The Daleks become sidelined in the late parts as the Thals take dominance. Not that there is anything wrong with the Thals, nor is there anything particularly interesting about them either. My favourite moment of the story is at the end of episode 4, when the travellers realise they have to go back to the city from which they have just escaped. After four parts, I think the 1963 audience would have accepted that to be the end of the story, but mostly there is no denying the place this story and the Daleks themselves hold in Doctor Who history. Without this story, the show wouldn't have lasted all that long at all. Yep. Next week, The Edge of Destruction, Marco Polo. Ah, Why didn't I write in last week? I could have won the signed photo. Well, I suppose it's fitting it that it fitting that int. Oh, in the same you review. I can't read that bit, so I Mary, you should have done this. Fitting that in the same you review
sorry.
Susan's last story.
You should send it to my Gmail.
Second, I did. I review Susan's first story and the Daleks' debut. But damn it, no. No signed photo. Oh, well. I would have had to change my name to Adam anyway. So it doesn't matter. So that's it for now, Mr. M. P.S. Assault Dalek. Ha, 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 ha. Somebody had to find it funny, Robert.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
God, it's all coming in thick and fast, this feedback stuff, you know?
Yes, wonderful.
Hello, 20 Minute Map Podcast. This is Ian Kirk.
Captain.
Volume's up. Let's be having you listening.
Dalek's Invasion of Earth by Terry Nation. There are several firsts in this story. The first companion departure. The first filming in a quarry. The first ill-treated miners. There are no sugar puffs in this. This story was remade in Japan with Peter Cushing. It was partly sponsored by the makers of the Sugar Puffs breakfast cereal. The Dumping Bodies poster was replaced by a Sugar Puffs poster. I thought the film was not as good. It stuck closely to the TV story, except there was no alligator and no slither. In the TV version, Susan twisted her ankle. Making the film version, a stuntman broke his ankle in the scene where one of the prisoners runs away and is shot by the Daleks. In the TV version, William Hartnell was away for one episode, injured when another actor dropped him. Making the film version was suspended for 2 weeks when Peter Cushing became ill. The bucket that Ian is carried in is probably the worst wobbly scenery ever. Labels on the Dalek diagram of the mine are in English, which is odd. Remember to avoid Bedfordshire and the M25. It looks like the Daleks have been wiped out once and for all.
Do you think any Daleks escaped?
In that, my dear, impossible.
I'm not dead.
So long, and thanks for the signed photograph.
Oh, you're welcome. That's
Thank
Ian Kirk.
Oh, and Adam, I did find your forward, but you sent it to a different email account than my Gmail account. And if you said said email and not Gmail,
all
I'm
right.
sorry I
I'm
misunderstood
to apologize.
You.
I misunderstood because I sent it from my Gmail thinking it went to your Gmail. I apologize. Meanwhile, I've got this from Patrick Bishop, who says, "Hello, everyone. It's Patrick from North Hollywood. Sorry I couldn't record something, but my Sundays have been increasingly busy for the past month. On top of that, I picked up a bad case of the flu from Gallifrey One convention. I'd love to go to that. The convention was awesome, by the way, and I'll try to give a little recap at a later date.
I hope so. I hope so.
I don't have feedback for this week's episode assignment. I just wanted to say that the podcast has been as great as ever, and I'm glad you've decided, for now at least, to continue the quiz. I'll have time to send in a proper audio feedback for next week's show for sure. Have a nice week. Thank you, Patrick."
Yes, thank you, Patrick. Yeah.
Which sort of partly and slightly leads on to this week's sort of introduction to people who have just joined the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group.
Did you see Ian's list?
Ian's list? No, I didn't see
Ian's
list. Oh, did I? Yeah, it says, so the last one on his list, therefore, was Ben Ellis. Most recent, or is it the other way around? Is this list in order?
I don't know. It could
in
be
reverse
most recent
order?
At the top.
Yes, Ben Ellis has been the last one.
Did anybody understand what Kirby said then? If they did, please tell me what he said.
Sound like
there's all kinds of. Hang on.
It's like somebody talking in reverse.
Close down all those windows.
Like one of those old Beatles songs from 1967. Did you say "I buried Paul" or something like that, Kirby? And you can buy the Beatles quiz book from all good places
better?
Like Amazon and iTunes. Yes, it is.
Is that better?
Yes, it is. Yes.
You may have noticed I've been doing things with pictures and posting them, and that was taking up bandwidth, I guess.
Really?
What a surprise. Okay, right. Welcome to new members of the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group, such as Christopher Lockery, Gary Gaydon, Simon Fisher-Becker, Mackenzie Yay! Williams, Carlo Yay! Robert D. Shelton, Yay! Justin Godwin, Iki Hoovian, Darby Quinlivan, and TJ Ariz. So welcome, everybody, and... Yes, Simon Fisher-Becker, thank you for joining the group. I don't think you'll be in the group for very long, especially after Robert sent you about 50 million notifications for liking stuff. But while you're in the group, and probably not listening to the podcast, it doesn't matter. Everybody's in a member of the group gets every single like that anybody... Oh, never mind.
Well, anyway. He can opt out of notifications.
Yeah, can he? I think it's more likely he's going to opt out of the group. But
you just can't control yourself, can you, Robert?
Basically, he probably asked you
I
and
just
everybody
hope we
else.
Can, we can get him. Yes? Can we get him on the podcast?
I did ask him. He said yes, but we haven't actually got around to who's rubbing their microphone. They're going to get told off.
It's not me.
We did that last week.
Yes. Sorry.
Oh, it's you, is
it?
What? You can't do
yeah,
what?
Yeah, sorry, I'm responding to something. I set the microphone down. I forgot I hadn't flipped it off. I apologize.
Yeah, okay. Anyway,
not paying attention to us.
Back to Mr. Fisher-Becker.
I am paying attention. I'm paying as much attention to you guys as you were paying attention to me when you were plugging in your phone earlier, Kirby.
Sorry.
Touché.
I gotcha.
Simon sent
the pictures I've been posting have been from my phone. Yeah, that's why you. I was plugging the phone in.
Simon sent me a sort of invitation to like something of his, so I thought, well, if I'm going to like whatever you're asking me to like, then I shall send you an invitation to join the group. I thought that was a tit for tat that worked quite nicely, actually. And yes, a while back I did ask him to come on the show. We just haven't got around to sorting anything out solidly yet, but I will get around to it at some point. So thank you to everybody who's joined the 20megabyte.2 podcast Facebook group. Therefore, I think we better look at news. Right, so according to... has anybody seen that lovely little video of Peter Capaldi trying to convince a little Doctor Who
yes.
dressed in a Dalek costume? It was on the 20 Megabyte Doctor
Isn't
podcast.
Isn't that gorgeous?
And, yes, bless him.
Right. Nice guy.
Lego, are they bringing out some Doctor Who Lego characters is the question, because there's one that looks just like Matt Smith.
Real Lego.
Are they doing it? Because I think the character might get a bit cross because of their little, Lego-ish things. But
Lego rip-offs?
I think Lego themselves could probably plumb more money into it and, just sort of bring out more characters, maybe. I don't know, but...
Well, the indication at the moment is that something has happened with character options license and that Lego may be picking it up. If you're talking about the image of the figure on the DoctorWhoNews.net site, that is a fan creation, not a real one, prototype or anything. So, but it's certain. So, but it does certainly seem like from the chatter I'm seeing that Lego may be doing something. And also given that Lego has a worldwide, I don't want to say fan base, but also reach.
Yes,
that exactly. Lego could, as you said, Lego could probably make could probably make far more money off the license and probably pay in more for a license than character options.
Perhaps the figures and everything connected, but it would probably be cheaper. But I think the idea of what character would do and having sort of, I think Lego do that as well. That you have a packet that you don't know what's inside the packet, what character you've got. Yeah. I'm pretty sure Lego do a similar thing with some of their creations. There was an event in Australia called Hooniverse, which got cancelled because Matt Smith had some family reasons.
Family emergency.
It hasn't been released, I don't think, as to why, but that is his personal thing. So we won't go any further down that road, but it's a shame for those people.
I did hear something with that.
You did?
I did hear that they were trying to get another doctor like David Tennant or Christopher Eccleston, but they couldn't, and that they may reschedule for a later date if possible.
Okay. The moon base, it says, the company responsible for the classic Doctor Who range of DVDs over the last few years have reported that several of the lead creatives involved in the production of the animated episodes of the recently released Moonbase were absent from the credits due to a technical error. So they've actually listed all the animators that should have been listed on the DVD, which I'm not going to do because it doesn't really matter. This is an audio presentation. Apparently, Mark Gatiss is to tour Brazil. What that's really got to do with Doctor Who news means that there's really not a lot of Doctor Who news up at the moment, so they're going to put little random
things he's doing a promotional thing, a combined promotional thing for Doctor Who and Sherlock, and it's an opportunity for... It's an opportunity for them to promote both of those shows, but also for fans and stuff to meet him, which is the reason why they're putting it on the page. Because according to the article, the article you're looking at, apparently Doctor Who's popularity in Brazil has really taken off.
Good.
Brazil. Anyway, good. Right.
Design a mixed-up monster with Doctor Who Adventures. Doctor Who Adventures readers have been invited to design a mixed-up monster in the latest edition of the Fortnightly magazine, and I do hope that monster doesn't become a monster in the series.
Yes.
Probably
after some
not.
Of the Peter creations over the years.
Yes,
leave a lot to be desired.
Exactly right.
Yeah, the only decent thing that shown up from Blue Peter in the new series was the junk TARDIS console thing and Doctor's wife.
Excellent. That's a funny word. Excellent. I just said it should be excellent. Anyway, a TARDIS-style police box aimed at fighting crime and antisocial behaviour in Bournemouth, as well as acting as a tourist attraction, is nearing completion. As previously reported, police in Boscombe wanted to reintroduce police boxes, and a councillor has been calling for their return for a number of years. Now it is soon to become reality, with Dorset Police saying a box will be up and running at the western side of the precinct in Christchurch Road this spring. Ooh, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Of course, there is already a police box in London, which you can see on Google Maps. Who's tapping on their blimmin' keyboard really loudly?
Me, I am, I'm
what
sorry.
Have you got to say for yourself?
Sorry!
Titan Comics releases preview of the first covers of the new series of the 10th Doctor and 11th Doctor.
That's not me this time.
That's me.
Doctor Who magazine celebrates 50 years of the Daleks. So there you go, that's an alternative
Which
cover.
Which magazine? Doctor Who magazine.
Yes. That'd be quite good. BBC Three is to stop transmission in 2015.
Why's that?
Because the BBC want to...
And what do they show?
TV programmes. Such as...
They're starting to go cyber.
Shush. Just let me finish what I'm saying. They used to show a thing called Doctor Who Confidential once upon a time. Adventures in Space and Time is going to be released on Blu-ray. I've got it actually in 3D in HD via iTunes, but I was saying a while back that they should release this on Blu-ray, and they are. But what they need to do is also release the Five-ish Doctors reboot.
Oh, please.
I've been reading up on this, and I think I know what might be the issue with it being released in the UK, but it would also might explain why they're having difficulties releasing it worldwide, which is some of the people who appear in it are not members of Equity, which is, of course, the UK Actors Union.
Yes.
And there are certain rules and regulations regarding this fact, particularly from the BBC releasing things. And it may be different because it was an online piece of online content rather than a television transmission, but it might also be causing issues with them being able to release it.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Matthew. Sad news. The actor James Ellis has passed away at the age of 82.
Richard.
Yes.
For me,
see the one in Battlefield?
He was somebody I first saw, yes. I first saw in Zedcars, a long time character in Zedcars. But of course, yes, like you say, he was in Battlefield. But he, when I was a child, he was quite a well-known face on TV. So very sad.
Yeah.
But like Robert said, he's probably had a very good innings at the age of 82.
This is Toby Whithouse, and you're listening to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
I'm looking for whowon.co.uk. Is that who won?
Who won that code?
Oh, okay. Whowon.co.uk.
Yes.
And LaBarzi.
Now, we're talking about the Doctor Who...
Yeah, Malcolm Turney. TNE.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
As the Terror of the Fairvise guy.
Thank you. Yeah, Doctor Who books, according to them, it's a Doctor Who book. It's in fact Doctor Who magazine number 471, which is all about the 50th anniversary of the Daleks, which deserves a little bit of an anniversary mention in itself, because without the Daleks, like Mr. M was saying, Doctor Who would still not be having podcasts made up about it. Or anything like that. But like I say, loads of stuff like that you can get at whoone.co.uk. Previous issues of the DWM, all priced at £4.99 plus postage. I've got a vast array of different types of things, like toys, T-shirts, CDs, DVDs, collectibles. Have a look at their website. It's, what is it, Mary? It's
who.one.uk.
Not quite. Let's try that again. www.whoone.uk.
Whenever it's my turn, I need to spout that out, I guess.
Yes, you do.
Yes.
Of course, we are also sponsored by Lavazzi, who do not just Doctor Who things, like the marvellous Fourth Doctor scarves, both of them, and I want the other one I haven't got. I wonder if I should get one as a sort of recipient of sponsorship. Probably not, actually. But yeah, of course, the scarves, the Seventh Doctor jumper, which I want one of, and of course the Seventh Doctor's scarf, and all the other lovely stuff.
Is Lavazzi UK based? Or
yes, it is indeed. It's lavazzi.co.uk. Okay. They do lots of other lovely non-Doctor Who related stuff. So have a look at their website too.
Yes.
Which sort of brings us on to this week's edition of You Won't Get This One.
We won't, you know.
We won't.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And don't be so down on yourself. I've noticed Matthew's keeping very quiet at this point.
Yeah,
so
what's
I think
with Matthew?
I've got a funny feeling
he's
Matthew
psyching
thinks,
himself.
I think Matthew thinks he will get this one.
Yeah, I'm here. I was posting
doing
the
something
links.
Else.
Yeah, posting the links on the 20 megabyte page that both An Earthly Child and Legacy of the Daleks that I mentioned earlier are available from whoone.co.uk.
It's a marvellous thing to do. Thank you, Matthew. Don't get you any extra points, but that's still marvellous. Right. First question this week goes to Kirby.
Master.
What is the title of episode 1 of Dalek Invasion of Earth?
World's End.
Oh my goodness.
No, I have to admit, the menu, the episode menu is up on my right hand screen right now.
You cheat. Right. Mary.
If Robert can use his notes, then Kirby can look at his TV screen that happened to be on.
TV.
That's just serendipity.
What is a television? TV?
Be quiet. Be quiet. Right. This is for Mary.
Up center.
I've written it wrong. I'm not going to say how I've written it because it's silly. Right. What reason did Ian come up with to explain why the place was deserted?
Oh, I know.
I have no idea.
Hey, guess what, everybody? Matthew knows.
It's a Sunday.
It is a Sunday, correct. This is your question, Matthew.
Can I make a joke?
Kirby's question? That was a much better question.
Robert, you're going to say it anyway, so there's no point in me saying no, is there? Go on.
There's a mass strike on a baked beans factory, and there was a gas explosion.
Right, Matthew, this is your question.
All right.
What does Ian see out of the window?
Did he say the reason?
Pardon?
Did he say the reason?
Because it's a Sunday, which is the same thing that the Third Doctor says when him and Sarah Jane arrive in a deserted London in the beginning of Invasion of the Dinosaurs a decade later as well.
Yeah, yes. That's what I mean.
And
yeah.
All it needed was... he thought it was a Sunday. Right then, Matthew.
Do I get extra points for knowing about Invasion of the Dinosaurs as well?
No.
Right, see if you can work out my answer.
You don't need extra points.
Not.
Well done. Right. What does Ian see out of the window while exploring the warehouse?
Battersea Power Station with a nuclear reactor added to it.
Yes. Robert.
Yes, sir.
What is Susan's response after Barbara admits she can cook and David asks her what she does?
I can eat.
Is sort of the correct answer.
I
Kirby.
Eat, then.
Yes, that'll do. Kirby.
Master.
What did the Robomen say when Ian asked them what they wanted?
I don't know.
No, they didn't say that. Anybody?
No Six. Idea.
The no. answer is stop. Mary.
Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
According to the Daleks, where must those who wish to surrender stand?
I don't know, in the center?
No.
I know.
Oh, go on in, Kirby.
In the middle of the street.
Is correct.
Well, how come the center doesn't work?
The center of what?
Exactly. The center of what?
We are just splitting hairs here.
No, we're not. Right. Matthew.
Yes.
What seems to be the best treatment available for a twisted ankle?
I know.
Jeez.
Bandages.
Why don't I get those questions?
I'll give you a point for that. It's a specific type of bandage, and you've frozen out now.
Oh,
water. Active water.
That'll do, Robert. Well, a wet bandage would have been all right. Right, Robert.
Yeah, I realise that.
How does the doctor...
It smells of sewage from the...
yes, exactly.
Yes, especially ones, yeah. Especially those, yeah.
Right, Robert. How does the doctor explain why the Daleks are okay and not destroyed on Skaro?
Because that's billions of years in the future. Their other selves.
Well, sort of not quite how it's explained in the script.
This is the middle of the history.
I have to give that point to Matthew, I'm afraid, because he said it first.
And do I that, get some point for that?
Not really, no. In last place,
I was
no
right because they were saying it's in part of
no, but
another
the word
history
middle
of
history was the. Part of the answer I was looking for there. In last place with no points, it's Mary. In second place with 3 points each, it's Kirby and Robert. And in the lead with 5 points, it's Matthew. This
You're
question
kidding.
Surprise.
That I knew it at all, I should get a point.
Right. Kirby. Kirby, this is your question.
Master.
Where do the Daleks take the prisoners to operate on them?
Into the saucer.
No. Anybody?
That sounds good enough to me.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good answer.
That's where they went.
Are you talking about Sloan...
No.
Whatever it was?
No.
Which I thought was odd.
It's the way it's said in the script.
Is it the transfer point?
The saucer is not mentioned in the script. Nope, the answer, as nobody seems to be coming up with it, is heliport. Mary.
Yeah, I knew that.
Okay.
I knew that too, but I didn't know that was what
mine.
Well, I did not know that.
Never
okay.
Mind. Stop arguing. Mary.
Yes.
Who was Jack Craddock in the story?
I know.
He was one of the resistance people.
Specifically.
Oh, that sounds good.
He was
to
in
me.
Prison. He wasn't very attractive. He wore. You know, worn out, dirty looking clothes.
Yeah, but he had a specific.
Have I hit anything?
Nothing.
See, Phil?
Matthew?
No. He's the guy who's in the cell with the doctor and Ian in episode 2. Who gives them.
I said he was in prison.
There's lots of prisons
wasn't he
in the
guy
story.
Who was looking for his brother?
No, that's okay. Larry later in the story, Robert.
Never mind. Right,
okay.
All right, Matthew.
Yes.
What year did the meteorite start hitting Earth? And you have to be spot on with this one.
Well, given that the actual dating of this story is hard to pin down, there is some considerable debate about it, but assuming you're going by the calendar scene in the first episode,
yes.
I'm going to assume 2154?
I'll do it.
That's what I would have said, because it's 10 years before.
It was 10 years. Yeah, I just didn't remember what was on the calendar.
That's assuming that the calendar was a current calendar.
Yeah, which is why dating this story is difficult.
Robert.
Yes, sir?
What do the Daleks offer humans if they work?
Their lives?
Correct.
And food?
No, life is the answer.
Okay.
Kirby.
Don't talk to me about life.
Kirby, what is Barbara's idea to infiltrate the Daleks?
Here I am. Rain the size.
I couldn't.
Well, sorry, you only get it once. If other people talk over the question, I'm afraid that's just very unfortunate. You just deduct points from the other people that talk over the question. Who is that then? That will probably be Robert.
Say again.
Right, here's the question. Right. What is Barbara's idea to infiltrate the Daleks?
To wear Robo-Man helmets.
That is the correct answer.
Excellent.
Mary.
Excellent.
Yeah.
What did Ian take at university instead of three-dimensional graph technology?
Sexology.
I don't remember.
Does anybody else know?
Yes.
Go on, Kirby.
Boyle's Law.
Is the correct answer.
That's right, yeah.
Matthew.
Yes.
Wasn't there a joke about boil or something boiling after something?
No idea. Matthew, what, after the Doctor masterminds the escape from the cell, what did the Daleks have planned for him?
To convert him into a Robo-Man.
Is the correct answer. Robert.
Yes, sir.
What are the Robo-Men ordered to do to the Doctor after they take off his coat?
To lay him down under the machine?
No. Anybody?
No.
Nope. The answer is anaesthetize him. And after that round of questions...
Did anyone notice how the Doctor somehow magically had his coat back on in the next scene?
Yes.
Right, in last place is Mary with no points. In third place is Robert with 5 points. In second place, Kirby with 6. And in the lead with 10 points, it's Matthew. And this is
Kirby's question. How surprising.
Kirby, what sector do the people trying to con themselves into the heliport pretend that the prisoners were taken from?
I guess Sector 4.
That would be a correct guess.
Really?
Yes.
Mary.
Oh, please, an easy one, please.
What did the Daleks intend to use to destroy London?
Firebombs.
Is the correct answer.
Yes! All right!
Yay! High
five.
Matthew.
And there was much rejoicing.
Who gets killed just after the Doctor is returned to David and Susan in London?
I can't remember that character's name.
Does anybody?
I know it's the guy who
his name.
Went back. He got the hip flask, remember?
And his name was?
Tyler?
Nope. The answer then...
Wasn't Craddock.
Nope. The answer is Baker.
Oh.
Robert.
Sure.
Tom or Colin?
Where is the mine situated?
Bedfordshire.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's really in Kent.
Kirby.
Can we forget all this blab about Bedfordshire?
Kirby.
Master.
What character was played by Alan Judd?
I haven't the funniest.
That's easy.
Go on, Robert.
Dortmun.
Correct. Mary.
Yeah.
What is the red mark on the bomb?
How did you know it was red?
How do you know it's red?
Because there's a line. I know because there's a line of dialogue about it.
Yeah.
There's a line of dialogue where Susan says it's red. It's when it reaches that point, the bomb will explode.
Yeah.
Did you just answer your own question or
point
someone else?
For Matthew. So, Mary, what's the answer?
He didn't know what the answer was.
The answer was... The red mark means that when the timer hits that spot, the bomb will explode.
So when the bomb explodes, that is therefore the...
Firebomb.
Oh, I'll give you a point. It's ignition point, Mary. Ignition point. Right, Matthew.
Okay.
How did David disarm the bomb?
Acid and pulling the detonator out.
Yeah.
I'll give you a point
Sounds
for that. I was hoping you were going to mention... where the acid came from, but
came from the bomb.
Came from Dortmund's bomb.
Nah, point for me. Yeah. Oh, that's the words I was looking for. Right, Robert.
Yes, sir.
I've lost where I was on my list of questions, so bear with me just a moment.
Frog right.
Yes.
Actually, I found it. Robert.
Yes,
where
sir?
Did Barbara used to live?
Ah, oh, because I know she was saying I used to live from it, near from it. It wasn't Bedford. No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
It's not Bedfordshire, is it?
Bedfordshire. Well done. Yes. Right, after that round of questions, in last place with 4 points, it's Mary. In third place with 8 points, it's Kirby. And actually, that's second place, isn't it? Because joint leaders at the moment, Matthew and Robert, with 10 points each.
What?
Right. Right, McKirby.
Master.
Who did Ian travel to Bedford with?
I know.
I don't remember his name.
That's a bit of a shame, Matthew.
I know. Matthew? I know too.
Larry.
Correct.
Yeah, Larry. Mary. Looking for his brother.
Yes.
What does Ian say when a Roberman says, do not resist orders?
Get new orders.
Correct.
Yes.
Oh, well done, Mary.
Wish I'd had that one. I knew that one.
Matthew.
Finally. Yes.
What is the name of the black marketeer?
Ashton.
Correct. Robert.
Yes, sir.
Who is the commandant of the camp?
I know.
The commandant of the camp?
Yes.
Ooh, what the hell?
I know too, but he's going to get it anyway.
Who's going to get it? Me?
No, Matthew.
No. I'm going to get it.
That's a tough one.
Give it to me. Give it to me. Give
which,
it to
camp
me.
Which camp are you talking about? Hold on. Which camp
give
are you talking
about? Give it
to
the annoying boy with his hand in the air.
It will be in Bedfordshire, won't it, Robert?
It's just the one where the black marketeer works.
Well, never mind.
Is that what you're
talking about? Give it up and
Robert,
give it to Matthew.
Matthew, go on.
The black Dalek.
The black Dalek is the correct
answer. Oh my gosh, yes.
Right. I was trying to establish which...
You were stalling for time, Robert.
No, I wasn't. Cause
never.
My brain isn't working.
Okay, Kirby.
Master.
Who saves David from being throttled by a Roboman?
I don't remember that scene.
I know.
Well, Matthew knows. Go on, Matthew.
It's Susan.
Not really, no. In fact, was the doctor whacking him over the head with a stick.
Yeah,
that's
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always found it interesting that they could whack those helmets with the simplest of things and those.
I know, and somebody gets knocked out.
Yeah.
Right, Mary.
I know.
Yeah.
How did the vagrant woman persuade Barbara and Jenny to stay with them?
Oh, by offering them food?
No. Anybody?
So they had food.
Yeah, place to stay, just somewhere to stay overnight because of the patrols.
Nope. They frightened them by saying they were dogs in the forest.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Matthew.
Yes.
How long did it take Ian and Larry to descend the shaft?
I actually don't know.
Does anybody know?
Mm-mm.
30 minutes.
I don't remember them mentioning
I'm glad you had a guess, Robert, but it's in fact 20 minutes. Robert.
Oh, yes.
That would have been an entire episode.
In what episode
that would be true.
Was the word exterminated first used
I
by
know.
A Dalek,
I know.
Robert?
Was that episode 5?
Correct.
No, very good.
I knew it was towards the end.
And not after that round of questioning, in the last place with 6 points, it's Mary. In third place with 8 points, it's Kirby. In second place with 12 points, it's second place. Oh God, flip me neck! In second place, I still with this lager I'm drinking. In second place with 12 points, it's Robert, and in the lead with 14 points, it's Matthew. This is Kirby's question.
Are we reaching a point where you can barely read your questions?
Not K9.
Right, Kirby. What was the name of Larry's brother?
I know.
I know too.
I know too. We all know that one.
I don't know that one.
Oh, well, go on then, Matthew. What was the name of Larry's brother?
Phil.
Correct. I thought we might get that one because with Dr. Phil and stuff. Mary.
Yeah.
Yes. Like I said, when I was watching this, all these extra characters were just they lost names for
Can
it.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Pay attention. Right. Mary.
Yes.
How does Ian stop the explosive capsule?
Say that again, please.
How does Ian stop the explosive capsule?
Well, he pulls out all the wires.
He does indeed.
Yes. Woo! Thank you.
The reason it doesn't explode, because the Daleks didn't expect that to happen. Matthew.
Yes.
What are the Robomen ordered to herd the humans into?
The lower levels of the mine.
Oh, I'll give you 1 point for that.
Well, oh?
The word that was used. Oh, what was... The word that was used in the script. Go on then.
Can I say? Can I say?
You can, yes.
Can I say? Lower galleries.
That'll do.
Ah.
Robert. Oh.
Yes, sir.
When Barbara attempted to stall the Daleks, what story did she try to tell them?
Ah, that was like all these invaders from history.
Oh, I loved her whole section there.
Yes,
like the busted tea party.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. Yeah. Thank you very much, Robert. Right, next question goes to Kirby.
Master?
When the Doctor sends David and Susan on their mission, what does he tell them not to do on the way?
Oh, I know, I know.
Pick daisies, pick
Correct.
Daisies.
Correct. Oh. Mary.
Yeah?
Why does the Doctor want to stop the Daleks from piloting Earth out of the solar system?
I haven't any idea.
Anybody?
Is it something about messing up the entire constellation?
I'll give you a point for that. It was.
It'd be a stupid idea anyway.
It was because it would upset the balance of the entire constellation, which is near enough to get a point. Right. Robert. Oh, no, sorry. Matthew.
Yes.
Who gives the Robomen the order to kill the Daleks?
I know.
The Doctor.
Correct. I thought somebody might have thought it might have been Barbara, but it was in fact.
Also, I thought
Barbara.
It was wonderful the way Barbara was, you know, flapping her hand in front of her mouth.
Yes.
Talk to them, and then the Doctor just kind of pushes her aside and shouts.
Well, you know what? Apparently, that's how Peter Hawkins, when he rehearsed the Dalek voices, when they're doing rehearsals, he did that same.
Oh, excellent. I didn't know that. Brilliant. Right,
patting
Robert.
His mouth with his hand?
Robert, this is your question.
Yes.
Robert?
Yes.
What are David's plans while rebuilding the Earth? What are his plans?
To get it on with Susan.
Not quite what I was looking
for. Oh, no, you know, to work the land.
Yeah,
to
that's, the that's land. What I was looking for, yes. Thank you. To be a farmer would have been...
But wouldn't he be doing that too?
Never mind.
Yeah, he probably would.
But work land, great. That's what I was looking for. Right. So, with four questions left in last place with 8 points, it's Mary.
As
in
always.
In third place with 11 points, it's Kirby. In second place with 16 points, it's Robert. And in the lead with 19 points, it's Matthew.
Really?
Wow, Matthew.
So, this is Kirby's last question.
Master?
Kirby, why can't Susan get into the TARDIS at the end of the story?
Oh, come on.
Locked the door.
So
hang on. Thank you, Kirby.
The Doctor locked the door.
But how did he lock that a specific
way? No, I know.
Oh, double lock.
That'll do.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Right, Mary.
Now I'm going to get the one that nobody can answer.
Are you? Well, this is it. What were Susan's last words to the Doctor?
Bugger.
No. Definitely not. Maybe after the TARDIS had dematerialized. But yes,
I don't remember.
Right,
don't remember what her last
get it
words.
Word for word because it's quite important. Anybody?
I know.
Go on then.
You would, Matthew.
Grandfather, I belong with you.
That is the correct answer. Right, Matthew.
Yes.
What is Susan holding in her hand as the TARDIS dematerializes?
Oh, see, and I know that one too, darn it.
The TARDIS key, which the TARDIS key, which in the one of the books I mentioned earlier, God Engine, the Seventh Doctor goes and picks back up.
Cool.
Oh. Excellent.
That's the correct
answer.
Because
I hate thinking that key was lying there for anybody to find in case they came across the TARDIS.
Correct. Right.
Yeah.
And Robert, last question. This is right up your street, this one. Who composed the incidental music for Dalek Invasion of Earth?
I know.
Oh, what's that guy's name? It was something funny. Francis Chagrin.
Is correct.
Who did a very good running through London sort of drum-beating thing.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Right, final scores, then, are... In last place, with 8 points, it's Mary. In third place, with 13 points, it's Kirby.
See, this is what happens when I don't study.
In second place, with 13 points, Robert. And the winner this week, with 22 points, it's Matthew.
Yay!
All hail the winner.
If only we were playing for cash prizes.
All right, so there we go. That completes this week's episode of You Won't Get This One, and more or less this week's episode of the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. All we need to do now is find out what we're doing next week.
Ah, we know what we're doing next week.
Yes. Yeah, we agreed on it last week.
Hey.
It's already posted onto the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. Okay. Well,
for people who aren't members of the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group, and that is clearly a reason why you should be a member of it, but nevertheless, not everybody is.
Production code 5H, of course.
Just say the title, Kirby.
City of Death.
Right. Oh, yeah. Not again. How many times have we done this? The only podcast in history where we've done City of Death 15 times.
No.
Ben did it once a very long time ago. We went through this when we decided to pick it.
Terrible smear on our reputation. Oh, you mean we did the City of Death. Okay.
And see, the rest of us want to talk about it because it's brilliant.
Oh, well, yes. That's some of that. So that's covered the City of Death.
Speak for yourself, Kirby.
What?
Uh-oh. What?
Oh, controversy.
That's covered the city. The only thing I will say about the city.
Blaspheme.
The only thing I'll say about it is be quiet.
Burn her.
Be quiet.
I'm not a witch. You put this nose on me.
Right. The only thing I'll say about be quiet.
It's not going to be like this week where we're all gushing. We actually have a dissenter in our midst.
We're quiet.
Okay, and when are
we doing this? Have I gone on mute or something? Hello?
Hello?
Yes,
hello?
Yes, we're here.
The only thing I'd say about City of Death is when we last did it, there was no quiz attached to it, so this time there will be. Yes, go on. When are we doing it? Well, I'm not doing it next blooming Sunday. Got another thing blooming coming. It'll be Monday, if possible. Thank you very much.
Yeah, because I can't do it on Sunday anyway. I have to take the geek daughter back to university on Sunday.
No, I can't do it on Sunday because if I do it two consecutive Sundays, my wife will cancel the podcast forever.
And you'd end up with one less computer.
Indeed. Thank you for that. Thanks for joining us, Robert, and hopefully we'll see you again next week. Goodbye!
Goodbye, fancy pants.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
And don't dump bodies in the river.
You better let us go.
We do not release prisoners. We are the masters of the earth.
Not for long.
Obey us or die.
Die? And just who are you to condemn us to death, I think we better pit our wits against them and defeat them.
Stop. I can hear you. I have heard many similar words from leaders of your different races. All of them were destroyed. I warn you, resistance is useless.
Resistance is useless? Surely you don't expect all the people to welcome you with open arms?
We have already conquered Earth.
Conquer the Earth, you poor, pathetic creatures. Don't you realize, before you attempt to conquer the Earth, you will have to destroy all living matter.
Take them. Take them. We are the masters of Earth. We...
Dr. Phil again with another installment of Adventures in Time, Space, and Music. In this segment, we'll be looking at the singular musical contribution to Doctor Who by composer Francis Chagrin, focusing on his work on Serial K, Story 10, The Dalek Invasion of Earth, a six-part story comprising of World's End, The Daleks, Day of Reckoning, The End of Tomorrow, The Walking Ally, and Flashpoint. Radiation nil, oxygen normal, pressure normal. An Earth reading. The TARDIS has landed in London, a menacing, deserted London with no sign of life and no sense of normality, but the decaying city is not as empty as it seems. The year is 2164, and the travelers soon find themselves facing antagonists whom they thought had been destroyed. The Daleks. They have conquered the Earth. 10 years after a cosmic storm, continents of people were wiped out by a plague. Then the Daleks came in saucers, shipping humans to vast mining areas, turning them into robo-men and against their fellow humans. Earth contains something no other planet contains, a magnetic core. But why are the Daleks digging for it, and how can the Doctor prevent them from tampering with the forces of creation? The BBC paperwork for that of World's End, Dudley Simpson and eight musicians are credited for performing 5 minutes of music. I'm not entirely sure this is a mistake in record-keeping, but it is indeed interesting nonetheless. While Francis Chagrin composed and conducted the score to the Daleks' Invasion of Earth, the information beyond that is sketchy, although the manuscript score does survive, as many do in BBC music. Chagrin's score being included in the Doctor Who exhibition during its London residency, as evidenced by Luke Harrison of the Minute Doctor Who podcast, who has been kind enough to send me a photograph from the exhibition. The paperwork on the BBC's site is vague at best, with Episode 2's incidental music coming in at 6 minutes and 44 seconds. For Episodes 3 through 6, cue sheets with incidental music timing is not included. A lot of tension in the story is accompanied by percussion in early episodes, mostly on snares, bongos, etc. Unlike the overtly atonal scores of Tristram Cary and Norman Kay, Francis Chagrin's is much less overtly dissonant, but in the case of the Dalek Invasion of Earth, the score is sparse, and whereas the music adds a great deal of tension, its absence does as well here. The iconic chase through London as Daleks swarm around the familiar landmarks of London is filled with percussion, as well as music accompanying the human revolt against the Daleks, the latter being punctuated by piano. Music accompanying Susan's departure is somber and melancholic, strikingly different to that score that preceded it. This cue strikes the right degree of sentiment accompanying the first departure of a companion in Doctor Who's history. I find it interesting that, over 20 years later, that Malcolm Clarke, also writing in a primarily atonal style, achieved a similar affect at the close of Series 21 in Serial P, Story 133, Resurrection of the Daleks. While Francis Chagrin composed and conducted this percussion-heavy bleak score for the Dalek Invasion of Earth, the ensemble of five musicians was supplied by Philip Jones, credited in Episode 6. As this is a rare connection in Doctor Who to any of the musical performers in 1960s serials, I'd like to elaborate on this exceptional musician here. Philip Jones was an English trumpeter who was born in 1928 and passed away in 2000. He studied at the Royal Conservatory of Music from 1944 to 1948. Jones had been the principal trumpet of many leading London orchestras, including the Royal Philharmonic from 1956 to 1960, the Philharmonia from 1960 to 64, the London Philharmonic Orchestra from 1964 to 1965, the New Philharmonic Orchestra from 1965 to 1967, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra from 1968 to 1972. In 1951, he formed the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble, which was made up of a brass quintet, two trumpets, horn, trombone, and tuba, as well as a larger 10-piece ensemble that toured in over 30 countries with many concerts in Germany, the United States, and Japan. Their repertoire spanned from transcriptions of early music by the likes of Monteverdi and Gabrielli to new works composed by such composers as Hans Werner Henze, Witold Ludoslavski, and Aino Johanna Radivara, altogether performing 87 world premieres. The ensemble, after a long career of many performances and 50 recordings, disbanded in 1986. Jones headed the Wind and Percussion Department at the Royal Northern College of Music from 1975 to 77, the Guildhall School of Music from 1983 to 88, and was principal of the Trinity College of Music from 1988 to 1994. Jones was made a member of the Order of the British Empire, OBE, in 1977, and a CBE, Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, in 1986. Composer Francis Chagrin described himself as Romanian by birth, British by nationality, and cosmopolitan by inclination. He was born Alexander Pauker in Bucharest in 1905 to wealthy Jewish parents who expected their son to take his rightful place in the family business. Chagrin reluctantly relented, if at first, secretly putting himself through the city's music conservatory while studying for an engineering degree in Zurich. After graduating in 1928, and after the support from his musical endeavors failed to materialize, he left for Paris, where he acquired his new name of Francis Chagrin, making a living performing in nightclubs, café chantant, and composing popular song. In 1933, Chagrin enrolled at the École Normale for 2 years, studying with renowned French composers including Paul Dukas and Nadia Boulanger, whose students included some of the most important composers of the 20th century. Chagrin traveled to Britain, where he settled permanently in 1936. During the Second World War, between 1941 and 44, Chagrin served as music director and composer for the French section of the BBC Overseas Service, and in particular the program Les Français Parlant au Français, for which he was decorated Officier d'Académie by the French government in 1948. Also in 1943, Chagrin launched the Committee for the Promotion of New Music, later the SPNM, Society for the Promotion of New Music. Chagrin launched the SPNM at a meeting of the Arrangers, Composers, and Copyists Subcommittee of the Musicians Union and was dedicated to the support and work of young and particularly unestablished composers. Chagrin was among many post-war composers who was supported and promoted by the BBC by Sir William Glock, who served as BBC Controller of Music from 1959 to 72. From 1960 to 1973, Glock was also controller of the Proms and took over single personal leadership of the Proms, whereas formerly a committee had been in charge of them. In addition to Chagrin, Glock arranged performances and commissions of works by many contemporary composers, included but not limited to Malcolm Arnold, Pierre Boulez, Luciano Berio, Elliot Carter, Peter Maxwell Davis, Hans Werner Henze, Gheorghe Ligeti, Witold Ludoslavski, Oliver Messiaen, Karlheinz Stockhausen, Michael Tippett, and many others. So, as Glock had been an advocate for new music, Chagrin was as well, even while working full-time for the broadcast services, tirelessly working towards the performance, broadcast, and recording of new music of the generation behind him as he composed his own works for many diverse genres. Chagrin's surviving art music is as numerous as his scores for television and film, the latter for which he produced over 200 scores. In addition to songs in French and English, as well as ballets, Chagrin produced a number of orchestral works, published primarily by Legnick, Mills, and Novello. Some of his concert works include his Suite No. 1, his Suite Medieval for Strings, and his Concerto for Piano and Orchestra of 1948. Other orchestral works include his Lamento Appassionato for Strings, Opus 10 of 1951, his Sarabande for Flute, Oboe, Violin, and Strings of 1952, an Elegy, the Aquarelles, Three Bagatelles, and his Romanian Fantasy for Harmonica and Orchestra of 1956, Prelude and Fugue, premiered at the Henry Wood Proms in 1947, and Castellana of 1968. In addition to these, Chagrin composed several symphonies, his first being in 1959, his second in 1970, as well as a third symphony, unfinished at the time of his death. He also composed for smaller chamber forces, including his Wind Octet, his Concert Rumba for two pianos in 1948, a Toccata for piano in 1948, 1950's Prelude and Fugue for two violins, a Suite Romaine for piano in 1950, a Divertimento for wind quintet in 1952, and his Divertimento for brass quintet of 1969. Chagrin also composed for less traditional combinations, Chagrin composed a set of Olympic sketches for a quartet of clarinets, as well as a significant amount of recorder music, inspired by no doubt by the Dolmetsch family's work in the early music revival to resurrect that family of instruments. Other works inspired by Baroque and pre-Baroque musical forms include his Orchestral Suite No. 1, featuring movements such as a toccata, fugetta, and finale, and 1962's Renaissance Suite for chamber orchestra, reminiscent of Peter Warlick's Capriole Suite, incorporating Renaissance compositional forms including an entrata, marziale, pavana and gagliarda, or pavan and gagliarda in English, canzone, and rondo giocosa. Among many of his songs that survive include a set of Shakespearean incidental music, and one of which, of course, resurfaced in 1954 score to the Colditz story. In addition to the Colditz story, Chagrin's career was extensive in film music. In addition to the Hoffnung cartoons and documentary film scores, some of his other films include Behind the Guns, 1940, Helter Skelter of 1949, Last Holiday of 1950, Castle in the Air of 1952, The Happy Family of 1952, The Intruder of 1953, The Beachcomber and the Inspector Calls of 1954, Simba of 1955, Charlie Moon of 1956, No Time for Tears of 1957, The Scamp of 1957, Danger Within and The Snorkel of 1958, Clue of the Twisted Candle of 1960, The Man Who Knew Nobody and The Marriage of Convenience of 1960, Walt Disney's Guy Frere's Bobby of 1961, and Cool of the Day, 1962. A year before working on Doctor Who in 1963, Chagrin was elected Film Composer of the Year of the Harriet Cohen International Awards. According to scholar Philip Lane in his essay on Chagrin's life, the composer worked to provide a lifestyle of wealth and ease he enjoyed in his youth in Bucharest, and by evidence of his prolific musical output, literally worked himself to death, suffering a series of heart attacks and passing just 5 days before what would have been his 67th birthday in 1972. Also, according to Lane, Chagrin's friends remember him as incredibly industrious, but selfless, resourceful, urbane, and with a great generosity of heart. His fellow composer, Benjamin Frankel, who wrote several obituaries of Chagrin, wrote that he was always able to see the lighter aspect of serious effort. While Chagrin's score to the Daleks' Invasion of Earth does not exist independently of the serial, some of his music is available, especially considering how prolific he was during his career. The film music of Francis Chagrin, a 2005 Shandos recording, catalog number 10323, features the BBC Philharmonic under the direction of Rumen Gamba, with premiere recordings of many of his works, mostly adapted by Philip Lane, who has written extensively about Chagrin. Recorded at Studio 7, New Broadcasting House in Manchester in 2004, this recording allows listeners to sample music from many of the projects I mentioned earlier, demonstrating Chagrin's colorful orchestration style, his rhythmically living composing featuring in the Yugoslav sketches from The Bridge, music from Four Just Men, Portrait of Ava, and The Colditz Story, just to name a few. In 2003, as part of the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who, the Doctor Who restoration team restored the Dalek Invasion of Earth with an extensive coverage of extras, especially considering how early in the DVD range it was. In addition to the standard production notes, photo gallery, and Easter egg, this two-disc set includes a Gary Russell-moderated commentary track featuring actors Caroline Ford and William Russell, director Richard Martin, and producer Verity Lambert, OBE, Order of the British Empire. Included is a CGI option replacing the Dalek saucer and Battersea Water Station. Also included is a look at the creation of the Daleks' voices entitled Talking Daleks by the actors who performed them. Also, here we find a now-and-then featurette comparing the 1964 locations to how they are today. In an interesting contrast, the featurette, Future Memories, showcases actors Bernard Kay, David Graham, Peter Fraser, Nick Evans, and others as they reminisce about the filming of the Dalek Invasion of Earth. While Future Visions is an interview with the story's designer, Spencer Chapman. Script to Screen traces how the cameras followed the camera scripts to create this story. In addition to a Blue Peter segment on Dalek cakes and Carol Ann Ford's 8mm home film from the last day of rehearsals for Dalek Invasion of Earth, BBC Radio's Whatever Happened to Susan Foreman is included, chronicling Susan's life, here portrayed by Jane Asher after she left the Doctor. The Dalek Invasion of Earth is a Doctor Who story that is a first in so many ways. The first in the return of a villain, the first in the departure of a companion, and above all a first, as well as a last, for Francis Chagrin, whose compositional ability was only to be heard in Doctor Who here. As a collector of Doctor Who, I highly recommend this DVD set as a vital part of any collection, which is a praise enough for a worthy story indeed.
Grandfather!
Listen, Susan, please. I've double-locked the doors. You can't get in. Now move back, child, where I can see you. During all the years, I've been taking care of you. You, in return, have been taking care of me.
Grandfather, I belong with you.
Not any longer, Susan. You're still my grandchild, and always will be. But now, you're a woman, too. I want you to belong somewhere, to have roots of your own. With David, you'll be able to find those roots and live normally like any woman should do. Believe me, my dear, your future lies with David and not with a silly old buffer like me. One day, I shall come back. Yes, I shall come back. Until then, there must be no regrets, no tears, no anxieties. Just go forward in all your beliefs and prove to me that I am not mistaken in mine. Goodbye, Susan. Goodbye, my dear.
Doctor Who Podcast is an APV Services production and is a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the BBC. No copyright infringement intended.